This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll discuss how the district boundaries are drawn for Congress and the state legislature in Michigan. But first, we remember writer Walter Dean Myers. The best-selling author passed away last week at the age of 76. Last year, Myers, who was the 2012 Ambassador for Young People's Literature, came to Kalamazoo. Before that visit, WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with Myers about his work and encouraging young people to read.
It is really quite fascinating that you've become an award-winning writer, and yet your father was an illiterate man, and you actually dropped out of high school. What made you drop out, and what turned it around for you?
What made me drop out was a combination of things. I projected my future, and I didn't see much going for myself. I did not have an appreciation of what being bright meant. I just didn't know. I just didn't see much of a future for myself because my family could not afford to send me to college. That was very clear. My dad was a janitor. My mom cleaned people's apartments. So they couldn't afford to send me to college. And I thought in my 15-year-old wisdom, well, if I can't go to college, what kind of a chance do I have? And so I dropped out.
You were born in West Virginia, but you were raised in Harlem. And you felt a little bit of embarrassment reading books in front of your peers. You didn't want to be seen with books.
My environment was not particularly book-friendly, as it's not particularly book-friendly today. Very often kids discourage other kids, especially boys. Boys will discourage other boys from reading, and especially in the inner city. So when you have these kids who are discouraged in life generally, they don't want to see other kids particularly succeeding. So it's it comes around to the point in which it creates an atmosphere of not reading. So when I go to juvenile prisons in particular, I see kids who will laugh at other kids who read, although if the book is right, you know, they are interested.
One of the things you did when you were younger, due to this embarrassment, you would go to the library with a paper bag, and you would put the books in a paper bag so that kids wouldn't see it. But you didn't stop. And that says something about you. What should young people draw from your experience that you didn't let this kind of embarrassment stop you and the teasing stop you from pursuing reading?
What kids need very much are role models, the idea of what's really plausible. When you say to a 12-year-old or 11-year-old that reading will do something for you, they might nominally agree, but very often they don't really believe it's going to happen to them. So when I walk into a school and I give kids my background, or kids have read my background, they look at me and they want to say, well, who is this guy? And look, he looks a little bit like us, and he has the same kind of background, but clearly he's done well with his life. And many kids will come out and ask me, am I rich? You know, they say, what kind of a car do you drive? Looking for signs of success, because that's the only thing they know. And said, well, if this guy can be successful, maybe I can. I remember going to a school once. A little 9-year-old girl came up to me and said to me after I had spoken, shown them some books, you know, she said, you're not so much. And at first I was thrown, but then I realized that the teacher had built me up, and she was saying to me, you're just like the rest of us. And that is a key thing to me. I want kids to be able to look at me and see that I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth. My parents were not educated people, and yet, through the gifts I had, I succeeded.
Upon your selection as a National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, you talked about that you wanted to focus on low-income minority populations. Have you been doing that in this year and a half?
Yes, I have been. I've been focusing on the lowest income Because what we tend to do is to dismiss these kids. We tend to say, well, they're not reading because they don't have the cognitive skills, or they don't read because their environment does not encourage them, and the environment won't encourage them. Well, you know, some of that is true, but I really believe that we can't afford not to try to bring these kids into the grand American picture. We have to do that. And I think I'm uniquely qualified to do that because of my own background. Whatever these kids are going through, whatever they are going through, I've been down that road. And so I can tell them that.
But I also understand that when you were younger, that you had a speech impediment and that it was due to a teacher who encouraged you to kind of put your thoughts down, that maybe you'd be better able to communicate that way, that led you to kind of writing.
That's true. You mentioned before I was born in West Virginia. Well, I was given to the Dean family to raise. So I was not raised by my biological parents. I was raised by foster parents. So I sort of understand where that thing is going. And I had speech problems for years. I went to speech therapy for 10 years, I think. And people could not understand me sometimes. And that led to a lot of, you know, teasing and fighting and what have you. But when I wasn't playing basketball or some other sports activity, I stayed home and read. That was my retreat. And that was good. That got me into a world I wanted to be in.
One of the things that you say is that reading is not optional. To not read, it's not an option. What strategies would you give to families to help increase the interest for reading? And what can communities do?
Okay, my mom, my foster mom, could only read at about, I would guess, a third grade level. But she read with me 3 or 4 times a week. What she read was true romance magazines, almost exclusively. And I would sit there with her. And she was not thinking that she was teaching me something. She, you know, it was just a pastime that she liked. And so what I say to people is that you have a gift to give to your child. You don't have to be highly educated, but you have a gift to give to that child. And it's up to you to recognize that. It's up to the communities to recognize that. And that every parent has this gift. What we're trying to do in New York, part of this program with the Every Child a Reader Foundation, is to set up a center in which parents or guardians, sometimes grandparents or what have you, can come and learn to read to their children. And reading is a wonderful way of spending some time with a child. It doesn't have to be done in long periods of time. 30 minutes a day, 3 or 4 days a week is wonderful. But that child will become involved in books. And what we need, we have all the research that's necessary. We don't need to bring the research into the public school system as much as we need to bring that research into the communities. And we need to explain to the communities that it's not the school that can solve the problem. It's the communities that can solve the problem.
I want to switch gears a little bit right now and talk about your work as an author. You're a children's author, primarily. I know you do some poetry. And our listeners should know that you have won 2 Newbery Honor Awards and 5 Coretta Scott King Awards. So you're really quite a distinguished writer. The themes that you write about has a lot to do with your upbringing. It's about things that affect teenagers in urban settings.
Yeah, I'm writing about my background a lot. One of the things that I want to do is to have young people open books and find themselves in the books. We don't very often write about inner city children. We don't very often write about poor children of any race. Nobody writes about them. So when they pick up a book, they're not going to find themselves. I have nothing against Harry Potter. I have nothing against any of these books that deal with more or less a middle-class population. I have nothing against those books, but you really need to have books which are inclusive of all Americans.
So this is a deliberate strategy on your part to help boost reading or interest in reading for children of color?
It's not a deliberate strategy. It's more or less writing about the things I know about and care about a lot. And I could have made a lot more money writing in a different vein. I could have written more books about white kids and get a larger market. But I said, well, you know, that's fine. That's good. But let me write about the things I know and the things that I would have liked to have read as a kid. You know, I remember as a child, like 14, 15, and my teacher introduced me to Balzac, who I thought was the most wonderful writer that ever lived. And I was thrilled to death to read all of his stories. And then read books by Anatole France and Pierre Loti. That was wonderful. But then I didn't find myself in the books. So when I became discouraged, I just did not find a place for myself in the world. I mentioned this when I met James Baldwin for the first time. And Baldwin said he felt the same way. And Baldwin, who lived not that far from me in Harlem, Baldwin did not find a place for himself. And he left and went to France to live. Richard Wright went to France. You know, I don't want kids going to France. I want people to find themselves in America. And I want white children to read about black children and look at them as complete human beings, not to look at them as only athletes or entertainers and what have you. But basically, I think I'm against the idea of I have a strategy to do this. I think basically I write because I love it. You know, I love writing. I get up every morning anxious to get to my computer. And I write fast enough, and I have been as successful as I have been, so I have options, you know.
Despite the very gritty and the really tough topics that you deal with in your books, there's a sense of hope. Is that important?
You have to give kids a sense of hope and a sense that they can rise above their circumstances. One of the things that I want to say to young people that although your circumstances might not be ideal, and they often are far from ideal, if you talk to some of the thousands of kids I've spoken to, people who with similar backgrounds do well, and it's not always the college education that you need. Or you don't have to finish college at 20 or 21. You can do things at your own pace, at your own level, but you have to believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, it's going to be difficult.
Why is it important that young people read? You say as you've gone out there, you've kind of found that some kids wonder why should they read? You know, they don't see how this applies. How's this going to make them successful ultimately?
Okay, right. Which is why I say to them, reading is not optional. Reading is not optional. And we allow kids to believe that sometimes. When we say things like, books can take you to faraway places, and a book is like a frigate, I think one writer said. And that suggests to me that, okay, all you have to say is, I don't want to go to faraway places, or I don't want to read about Harry Potter's world, and it's fine. It's not fine, because you have to be able to read to survive in this country. And, you know, one of the things that I discussed in the book, All the Right Stuff, is that there is a social contract in existence. Whether you want to deal with it or not is totally immaterial. You have to deal with the social contract. And the social contract says that in our society, there are skills needed to succeed. And that what we will continue to do, because we appreciate these skills, is to structure the society so that reading is important, so that high school graduation is important. And you have to recognize that. You don't have a choice. It's like playing in the NFL and saying, well, I'm not a physical person, but I'll play. No, you won't.
My understanding is you also tackle a lot of historical topics in some of your books.
I'm so interested in history. It's just fascinating to me to, for example, now I'm working on a book on flyers, black flyers, and how many women flew back in the 30s. That's just fascinating. I mean, once you discover that, you really have to bring that history to young people and to say to them, look, this is who you are as much as some civil rights person.
Sounds like you're filling in some information gaps for young people or knowledge gaps.
One of the things that I've been working on over the last 2 years, maybe 3 years, is the idea that when people don't read, they create not only a language gap, which is clearly recognizable and which holds them back in life, but there's a knowledge gap that's stunning. It's so stunning that kids don't know anything about stuff that happened within the last 50 years. I am stunned when I talk to kids and they'll ask me questions like, when the Vietnam War happened, how did your brother get there? Did he take a bus? You take a bus? Do you know where? They don't know where Vietnam is. They can't find it on a map. And these things hurt kids. They have a limited understanding. They have a limited understanding of what's going on around them. And that stops them. That stops individuals.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the author Baldwin that you had right down your block there.
Baldwin was, his father was a minister and what have you, and when they did not have a good relationship. But Baldwin looked for a way. He liked language, and he did not want to be labeled simply a black person. He wanted to, because he was a reader, he wanted to be labeled an intellectual and a writer. And that was wonderful. But then in his reading, he told me that he'd never encountered himself in all the literature that he was being exposed to. So when he began writing, putting his own community, not all the time, of course, but in his books. So when I first read the first short story that I read of his was a story called Sonny's Blues. And it's about a young man struggling with a drug addiction. But wow, that moved me because it was in my neighborhood. This is my neighborhood. He's talking about my streets. And I devoured that story. I read the story over and over again. And, so when I finally met him, I said, that was the greatest story of my life.
How old were you when you met Baldwin? And how old was him?
He was about 12, 14 years older than me. I guess I was about 30.
Sounds like he was very receptive to you as another writer.
Because I was introduced to him by another writer, a novelist, John Killens, who wrote And Then We Heard the Thunder. Black writers, they look at each other and they have a kinship. When I was a very young kid, Langston Hughes came to my church to read. At that time, they did not sell many black books in bookstores. And so people would do the church things. You would go into a church with a suitcase full of books and sell them at night, which was kind of cute. But I wasn't interested in Langston Hughes because he was quite a bit older than I was. And he turned out to be a great guy because he helped us when I was in my 20s. Langston Hughes helped the group I was with then to put together a magazine. So,
Thank you for joining me today on WMUK.
Thanks for having me.
WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with author Walter Dean Myers last year before the Ambassador for Young People's Literature visited Kalamazoo. Myers died last week. He was 76 years old. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Many political observers will say that the August 5th primary is, in effect, the election for many of Michigan's congressional, state house, and senate seats. That's because the districts are safe for one party or the other, making the election between Republicans or Democrats the only possibility for a competitive race. Michigan Campaign Finance Network Executive Director Rich Robinson wrote about this recently for the online magazine Dome. His column was titled "Democracy Deformed." Rich Robinson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, good to be with you, Gordon.
Explain, what's the problem with the way that we draw the boundaries for congressional districts as well as the districts for state house and senate in Michigan?
Well, drawing the districts is strictly a legislative matter. Can be appealed to the courts. And right now, for the second consecutive redistricting process, Republicans have controlled the entire process, having majorities in both chambers of the legislature, the governor to sign the bill into law, and essentially a Republican Supreme Court is a last court of appeal on any redistricting. And when it's in a partisan control, the first object of drawing the lines is to protect majority and control. And the way that's done is to pack the opposing party into a minimal number of highly concentrated voters of the opposing party. So in this case, the Republicans pack the Democrats into as small number of seats as possible. And what this does is distort how the vote of the population translates into representation in the various legislative levels. It's a more exaggerated effect the greater the population in the district. So if you think that representation should generally directly reflect the vote, you'd expect a party that gets 50% of the vote to get 50% of the representation. And we get far away from that kind of a ratio, not as far in the smaller districts, the Michigan House of Representatives. But by the time you get to the congressional districts that are so large and so populous, it turned out in the 2012 congressional elections that Republican votes were worth twice as much representation as Democratic votes. That is, for the percentage of the representatives who are Republicans, which was 9 out of 14, they won that with just less than 46% of the vote. So what you end up with is a misrepresentation of what the voting sentiment of the state as a whole is in our congressional representation. And that Michigan was not alone in that. This happens in other states. And I'm sure if Democrats were in control of the process, their motivations would be the same, not to keep communities of interest together, but to assure the political majority.
And the fact in your column, you point out that in Illinois, where Democrats do control the redistricting process, it turns out that it's tilted in their favor in that state.
Absolutely. It wasn't as extreme as what it was in some of the states where Republicans controlled, the most extreme being Pennsylvania and Ohio. But absolutely, Democrats do the same thing as Republicans. They attempt to assert a permanent political advantage. And that's the problem, as I say. We're not representing voters. We're gaining political edge for a partisan organization.
Now, in following your column on Dome, there was the comment section, which included one from Stephen Linder, a partner with the Lansing-based Republican communications firm Sterling Corporation. He noted that you and him don't often see eye to eye on much of anything. He points out that the legislature is under some constrictions in both the state constitution and under federal law to, for instance, maintain minority-majority districts. Are there some other pressures which are working on the legislature as they draw these maps that could skew the partisan advantage, even if they were trying their hardest not to skew it themselves?
Well, they're under statutory guidance that they have to break a minimal number of political jurisdictional lines in the process. So that's a measure of a successful redistricting on one sense, how few county lines are broken, how few city boundaries, township boundaries, that kind of thing. That may or may not make entire sense, but the thing is, the track of the jurisdictional lines isn't just reflecting some kind of legal requirement. It's done to pack seats in such a way that they can be controlled. And if you look at, for example, and it's really in Southeast Michigan where this was carried out very effectively, the 11th Congressional District, the source of that seat was really to try to draw a more secure seat for Thad McCotter, who got caught up in the business of the fraudulent nominating petitions and resigned from Congress. That district excludes the city of Farmington from Farmington Hills, comes up and makes kind of a curl around Bloomfield Hills. It's at a location where a tall person could stand astride three congressional districts, and that wasn't anything to do with any kind of statutory requirement. This was very cleverly drawn. There's actually kind of a spiral of districts around Bloomfield Hills that were meant to distribute heavily Democratic votes into Sandra Levin's district and try to make a secure 11th when it was drawn for Thad McCotter.
Are there states which have come up with some idea for an independent redistricting process, in other words, where the lawmakers themselves don't draw the lines, who have found a system that does seem to be more fair and more equitable and does truly reflect what the voters show when they cast their ballots?
Well, there are certainly attempts out there that are fraught with all kinds of problems, too, and I guess that's a concession we need to make in this. There's no ideal way to do this. California has gone to kind of a hybrid bipartisan, nonpartisan commission to draw the lines, where Republicans and Democrats are represented, but then self-declared independents are represented. And there was an open nomination process from the public, and they got 30,000 applicants to be part of this system. They've combined that independent commission with the so-called jungle primaries, where the top two vote-getters in each primary election go forward. So you could have a Republican and a Democrat, or you could have two Republicans advancing to the general election.
And that, I was just going to ask if it seems like that has produced a process which does seem more fair.
I think the verdict is probably out on that. There was some criticism in reporting by ProPublica how in public hearings people would come out representing a group, but in effect be related to an individual politician trying to secure a seat for an incumbent. So my suggestion about redistricting was get experts in economics, in sociology, in political science, to consider different things. And an example of a community of interest that might be served, Joe Schwartz, former congressman from Battle Creek, is one of my board directors, and he's made the comment about redistricting that Battle Creek and Kalamazoo were historically connected in a district, shared an airport, shared a lot of economy, and so it made sense for a representative in Congress to be rooted in both of those communities. So I just suggest that there are different ways that of grouping people that make sense rather than strictly partisan advantage. And I think voting rights requirements can be protected in that kind of system. That's why I'd say get demographers involved. They know the many ways in which populations are related.
Rich Robinson, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Rich Robinson is Executive Director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.